The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. From national security to global corruption, you're with Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. We have a lot to discuss today with our expert witness. He is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Tony Schaefer, and we're going to talk about domestic politics and problems in the United States right now. And later in the broadcast, we will start talking about the threat that the People's Republic of China poses to the United States and their global objectives and what is really behind their ambitions and their most recent moves. Right now, let me welcome Colonel Schaefer to Through the Looking Glass.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me. It's good to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
It's good to have you. Recently, we discussed with another author, a person who's running for the United States Senate from the state of Virginia, the current politics. And we're hearing even in members of Congress discuss something about a national divorce. Yeah. Has the nation gotten to this point where we have irreconcilable differences and something is going to happen to cause the union to split, do you think?
I can only speak from my personal experience, and I think in many ways we're heading that way. I live in a little town in North Carolina called Edenton. It's very red, very, very conservative. As a matter of fact, I took my son out tonight for dinner. We had the Mexican restaurant there at the restaurant in the booth next to us. I ran into the county commissioner, the chairman of the county commissioner. He runs the county. Everybody knows everybody down here. There's issues. There's, still shootings in the bad areas of town, but everybody knows everybody. It's very much like Mayberry RFD with technology. It really is. And it really is solid red. I mean, it's solid red. And everybody, and by the way, everybody appreciates the fact we have freedom. Now, I moved out of Northern Virginia, probably not too far from where you're physically sitting this moment. I used to live in Fairfax County. And that county, especially when the Soros-backed prosecutor came in, went rapidly downhill. Crime went up. People became very aggressive. They weren't friendly. Ken Cuccinelli was my senator when I first lived in Springfield. Obviously, that changed a lot. And so I can only observe that where you see progressive or left-wing politics inculcate into the fabric of culture, things go bad. And yet somehow they want more of that. It's like, okay, that's not for me. So that's why I'm very happy being where I'm at. And I can tell you right now, the values of where I'm at in North Carolina, and North Carolina is very much going in the direction of Florida. It's becoming much more of a free state. I don't even call it conservative. I think people just want to be free. And places like Northern Virginia, Virginia itself has become more purple, almost to the point of where it's a solid blue. I think you're going to see such significant differences in the approach to policies. There will be a point of break, a breaking point, where the cultures of the left and the cultures of the right are not compatible. And you may well see a definitive split, because I'm telling you right now, Scott, the people down here aren't digging a lot of the stuff coming down the pike from Washington, D.C. regarding some of the left-wing progressive policies, such as green energy, the issues regarding the Second Amendment, the idea that, we're each sponsoring, without regard to our wanting to do it or not, illegal aliens to the tune of tens of thousands. All these things are not values that the people I consider my neighbors are into. And I think there's a real, I don't think that they're not going to back down. So if the left's not going to back down and the conservative side is not going to back down, you're inevitably going to have a divorce of some sort.
How does this end up? I mean, you and I have seen this in other countries around the world.
Yeah.
And what do you see happening? I mean,
that's an excellent question. I've actually had to address this a couple of times on, believe it or not, MSNBC, when they used to have a show called The Five on, and Torre once asked me about culture and breakdown. And this is how I see it. The left always talks about how they run these big states with big production and all this other stuff. But they neglect to understand that the reason those blue states do so well is because you actually do have a very strong blue collar and agrarian and energy sector production that supports the big cities. There's been times where cities like New York were cut off due to natural disasters. As a matter of fact, one of the hurricanes came and basically did damage. I can't remember which name it was, but it the city was down for about a week and no resources came in. Garbage couldn't be picked up. Food couldn't get to the bodegas, not the bodegas, whatever Miss Dr. Jill Biden says about them. The bodegas were not being serviced. People were going to be to the point of starvation in a very short time and probably lacking basic water and sanitation. Let me tell you something. If that goes on for more than a week, you're going to see large cities fall rapidly, and they forget rapidly in current good times that these big cities, these big areas of blue, cannot exist with large supporting areas of red. So if there's a divorce, I forecast that you're going to see massive collapses of these large archipelagos of blue, the big cities, the big areas where they don't recognize how vulnerable they are to all of the services, resources, and requirements that are provided to them by middle America, by flyover states. And I think what you're going to see very rapidly is that those states which have resources and good governance are going to rise back up rapidly. Those places like New York, Boston, Washington, Cleveland, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle, they're all going to become wastelands very quick, and they're going to regret the divorce because it's going to be a very brutal divorce. I think it's going to really impact most directly those cities with large populations and few resources. So if it happens, it could happen. But I think those in red states are going to come out pretty darn good. And those in the blue states who, by their own arrogance, have decided that they're smarter than everybody else and they don't care about energy. They have this green dream, this renewable energy fiction. And I guess they can live off air because they're not going to get the resources from the red states. And it's going to be a very difficult time.
Well, the evidence underlying your forecast is seen clearly by those of us who live in blue states, blue areas. Yeah. I'm in Pentagon City, which is not quite.
I love Pentagon City, but you're right. Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
But we can see the dysfunction around us constantly. When I go into the city virtually every day, you see the dysfunction, and of the blue areas. When I'm in New York City, you see the dysfunction of those areas. They cannot sustain themselves for very long. But getting to that point, I mean, right now we're seeing mild self-segregation where people who are in California or they're in Colorado or New York are heading to states like Georgia, Florida, Texas for a different kind of governance. Right. And they're fleeing those blue states that are dysfunctional in every characteristic of the word. And so in the process of this self-segregation, it actually gives the Democrats more power, because with the heavy concentration in a few areas of conservative voters, you'll have this situation where they will ultimately have power, almost all the power. So what are these states going to do at some point? Are they going to raise a barrier and say no more? Are they going to have a plebiscite vote and say we no longer want to be part of this? What's going to happen? And then what will the remaining authority in the United States do to punish those states, do you think?
That's a great question. There's a TV series that I watched a few years ago called Jericho. I recommend it to people because it actually kind of it's about a false flag nuclear attack, which results in the bifurcation of the United States. I highly recommend it because it kind of goes through some of the things we're talking about in a more expressive format. So to answer the question as best I can, I know down here where I live, it was really funny. I ran into one of the local prosecutor at an event right after I moved down here, and he looked at me and he said, I told him where I was from. He says, "Are we going to be friends?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're not a liberal, are you?" He's like, "No, I'm not a liberal." And so I think there's clearly already kind of a sense of us and them that's coming up throughout the country. And you have, like you mentioned, in certain blue areas, people are leaving. New York in particular, going south to Miami and other places in Florida. California people moving out to Arizona and Texas. So the danger, obviously, is that people bring their politics with them. And it's kind of like... I always look at people, and there's a couple near where I live here who have kind of tried to bring their politics down, and they're really not welcome. I mean, they're not shunted or anything, but it's kind of like, yeah, you need to say watch what you say around them, because they don't get it. And so I think you're going to see this migration, people voting with their feet to it, if they can economically afford it. Remember, a lot of folks may feel that they'd like to move, but can't because they just don't have the economic resource. I think a lot of people in Detroit would move right now if they could, but I don't think they can afford to do that. New York City as well. So I think what you're going to see when this actually occurs is that some states will indeed, I think, be a lot more exclusive, I guess is the best way of doing it. They're going to be a lot more able to kind of control who comes and goes, not so much through totalitarian control, but just cultural welcoming. I was welcomed here because people, you know, I'm a public figure. People knew who I was. I was warmly welcomed because they knew my politics. I can tell you that in certain states, if I showed up, say, you know, in Massachusetts, I don't think I'd get that kind of warm reception. And by extension, then I think some people who probably shouldn't be in certain states are going to be discouraged from being in those states. And I think they're going to feel that they're going to be not welcomed. So I think that's the way it's going to start. People kind of feeling not welcomed, like, you know, your politics are not welcome here. If you bring your politics, you need to think about twice about being here. I've seen some articles in some publications regarding California's moving to Austin and being totally shocked about being, you know, it's a conservative area. And so I think some of that's just going to sort itself out that way. But on the larger issue of real bifurcation of real segregation based on politics, I think it's going to come down to mostly economics. And you may have enclaves within states which remain kind of loyal to a certain political cause, but I think they're going to be very limited in their ability to influence the larger states. So the state, I think what you're going to see is a voting by state about how the union goes forward. And what's going to be left to the federal government? Damn little, and probably rightly so, because that's the issue right now. The federal government seems to have amassed so much power outside of its authority. I've asked a number of friends, can you show me in the Constitution or the amendments to the Constitution where it says the government can tell me what kind of light bulb I should or should not buy? Is there anything in the Constitution that tells them that a piece of plastic should make me a felon because I own it? Because some bureaucrat somewhere decided that I shouldn't have an arm brace for a gun? It's those sorts of things which I think the federal government has way overstepped its authority. And I think some of those things that are clearly authoritarian and have no basis in the Constitution need to be rethought anyway. And if the government essentially falls apart, then all those federal authorities and the ability to enforce those things goes away as well.
We're speaking with New York Times bestselling author and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. Colonel Schaefer, we've got a couple of minutes before the break. I wanted to ask you about the what is the reaction going to be? We saw, for example, in the 2020 election the summer where there were riots in so many places, and the federal and including federal buildings being attacked. Is that something that is going to increase as we see this division and self-segregation of people based on politics?
I think so. I mean, it's very clear that in many of those areas where you had those large riots, it was kind of welcomed. I hate to say that. I mean, a city that I knew pretty well because I used to spend some time there is Minneapolis. I loved Minneapolis. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Sure.
I loved that city. I mean, back in the days of Glam Slam and Prince and You know, I used to come off missions in the Far East, literally. I mean, this is a true story. I'd come off missions and I'd want to decompress because I'd been spending time in Japan and Korea doing dangerous things. And so I had friends in Minneapolis. So I get off the plane and spend a couple of days there just chilling. So I would literally go uptown to a cafe called Cafe Weird and sit with my lesbian friends and watch Girls. It was a great time. Those times are long gone. The idea of people of diverse backgrounds sitting down and having conversations just isn't there. And that city was destroyed by this woke mob. And so I just don't understand how people I used to respect, you know, I, for the record, I don't care who you sleep with. I don't care a lot of these things about, you know, all these cultural war things. If you start doing things to kids, clearly I care. They've crossed the line on that. But these other things they want to protest. The fact that they allow protests that go so far as to destroy the very infrastructure of minorities tells me that they've lost the bubble. And in many of these cities, the fact is that the political class allows this to happen. And the more they allow that to happen, the more it's going to happen. And so, yeah, I think that because of those riots, there's been a very clear, bright line drawn between the political parties. And unfortunately, I think it's going to be something that only resolves itself by things getting worse before they get better.
It, not only tolerating it and allowing it, they've actually encouraged it in right. So many of these cases, which to me was shocking. I actually covered a lot of these Antifa riots, was right in the middle, while my colleagues were saying that it wasn't, it was mostly peaceful. I was seeing an entirely different story from the right. inside. And I actually wrote at one point, wrote an article where I interviewed an NBC television reporter, and she was not very happy with the outcome of that reporting. But I, as I pointed out, I was there. I saw the same things you did. How did you come away with a mostly peaceful and really no violent report yeah. when it was there was, you know, hundreds of explosions right. at that time, so, most of them small. But we'll take a short time out. When we come back, I'm going to ask Colonel Schaefer about, is there a federal war under the current federal government, a war against local police, and why that, what might be the reasoning behind that? And we'll get more right after this. You're listening to TNT Radio's Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
They were arrested, charged with all kinds of horrific things that they allegedly did with their two adopted boys, including sharing them. And we also have one of them involved in another episode years ago. What's the latest?
The judge did agree to sever the cases. They were jointly indicted as co-defendants. And one of the defendants that you had asked before if they would elect for spousal privilege, since they are a married gay couple. So it appears that doesn't matter. The judge ruled that they should be required to testify against each other from the witness stand. And so it'll be interesting to see if either of them does take a plea negotiation.
All right. So that's going to be interesting, that even though they're married, they can testify against each other or be forced to testify against each other. I wonder if that will be a reason for appeal down the road. You might find some liberal judge who might say that. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that just doesn't seem correct. I don't know how you can arbitrarily decide to throw out that spousal privilege, which is what they unfortunately have, I think.
The Steve Malzberg Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated Sam Sam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our Sam Sam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at Sam Sam Yao Noi. Book your stay today at Sam Sam Yao Noi and experience our magic places. magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
This is Through the Looking Glass with Scott Wheeler on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Today, we're talking to New York Times bestselling author and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. Colonel Schaefer, going into the break, I mentioned that it seems like there's a war on local police, and you are, do you have an opinion of this? Have you seen something like this before? And what is the objective of it?
So, yeah, let me break it down in two pieces. I actually still, for full disclosure, I'm still a member of law enforcement. I actually am a volunteer member, and I'm the Homeland Security Advisor to Sheriff David Decatur down in Stafford County, just south of you there in Virginia. And I'm his rep on the NYPD's Extended Counterterrorism Task Force. Believe it or not, NYPD, I think, does a better job of information sharing and coordination than the FBI, just saying.
Well, their intelligence is run by really smart people, or used absolutely to be. I can't speak now, but I know my old friend from the agency, Bruce Teff, was their advisor.
Yeah, Bruce is a cool guy. I know Bruce. Yeah.
Oh, you do? Absolutely. Yeah, he's a good friend, longtime friend.
And so I'm just saying, yeah, they decided to actually do intelligence right, still do. And I that's all I want to say about it at this point. But yeah, they do a great job. And so my experience is both from that lens, because I still interact with law enforcement on a regular basis, as well as my position as someone who has to do policy and analyze this. So there's two pieces which I think have really hurt law enforcement. First is fentanyl. Fentanyl has touched every community in the United States, every community. There's not one that has not been an effect. And I think we should probably talk about this separately at some point. I do believe fentanyl is a weapon of mass destruction designed to do what it's doing by the Chinese, to be created by these cartels, these mafias in China. The Chinese government knows what's going on. They say, oh, they're mafias. No. You know what's going on. And these things come up. And so they've weakened the fabric of every community by this enormous infection of drug overdose doses. And law enforcement is the first line. Law enforcement's had to adapt their approach to this, because I work with some of the folks. The first option often when you come up on someone who's clearly been infected, you know, is basically OD'd, is to try to find a way to put them on a path to recovery. That's always the first option. Law enforcement, putting people in jail is not the best option, especially if you consider this to be an addiction. So I think law enforcement's had to make some really correct adjustments. Sorry about my bad English there. Correct adjustments to figure out how to do this more. And ONDCP and other federal agencies actually have been very helpful on this. And so I see a lot of this and I think it's good. So that's kind of an area where law enforcement has been challenged, but they're doing their best to react to that.
We saw especially during the Obama administration, when Eric Holder was the attorney general, this idea that they should go investigate local law enforcement agencies, the county sheriffs, local police forces, to find out if they are meeting the Obama administration standards on. Right. On critical race theory or
well, that's the second thing I was getting. Yeah.
Yeah. So please, that's problem. Yeah, go ahead.
So that's the problem. So I was going to say that's the other area where it's not been a good news story, is this wokeism that's permeated from the federal government on down into law enforcement. Remember, I mentioned NYPD being effective. I did not mention FBI being effective. And the FBI, it drives most of that nonsense you're talking about down to the local level. Full disclosure, and I don't think David will be too happy with me. David Decatur brought me in because he wants to resist this onerous federal, I don't want to say anything to get me in trouble here, but nonsense that gets pushed down to local law enforcement. And that's the thing. Local law enforcement are very effective. They know their areas. They are responsible for their citizens, especially sheriffs. Sheriffs are great. The federal government has detached itself from reality. And in many cases, the Eric Holder era was where they were trying to literally federalize police forces. Now, let me tell you something. The federal government does many things fairly well, trying to provide a unanimity of effort under something like the FBI is a really bad idea, especially based on some of the recent disclosures of politicization of the FBI. So I think that's a very dangerous area. So you combine that effort to basically denuder remove any ability of local law enforcement to aggressively deal with crime. And I think that's what it's about, Scott, is trying to basically reduce law enforcement's ability to react rapidly and effectively to crime. If that's what your objective is, that's what the federal government is trying to perpetuate, then you don't want to do that. And I think this is something most agencies have figured out, but not all. Larger cities have embraced these equity concepts, not equality, equity. And I think we know the difference based on kind of probably your audience knows the difference on that. So these equity issues then result in things like high crime, criminals being, committing a crime in the morning, being back out in the afternoon, committing another crime at night, and getting away with it over and over. And we've seen this in Chicago, Boston, Baltimore, New York, all these places. So when you have that environment, Seattle, when you have that environment, law enforcement's damaged by the fact you're not going to have officers. And by the way, I'm just going to stay a little secret. People where you live there, Scott, and in Pentagon City, the police there are very passive. My son is a fireman in Arlington, and I'm telling you right now, police are so afraid to enforce the law, so even in Arlington, because Arlington's become essentially a city in Europe. I mean, they've run the city like they're in Europe, and they're so passive on crime. It's amazing to me that more crime has not become prevalent within those jurisdictions. And that's the other issue. Law enforcement can't do its job. And if you do your job, you become the target. So those are the two challenges, as you mentioned. The one is the Obama-led and still existing push for control and oversight of agencies relating to how they implement equitable agendas, as well as those jurisdictions where the local jurisdiction has decided, we don't want you to enforce the laws, and we're just fine with lawlessness. And the people who pay the price, besides citizens, are the law enforcement officers who are caught in the middle, who can't actually enforce the laws. And often, if they do enforce the law, they become the one targeted for some sort of punishment.
Well, you and I both remember when the Democrat Party hated the FBI and hated the military. They hated the CIA. They were they undermined everything they were trying to do when they were defending the country. And then the moment the Democrats basically got control of the seventh floor, suddenly the FBI became the pillar of integrity, as long as they could use them for their own political ends.
Right.
And now you have this, you've got the Capitol Police opening up bureaus around the country, almost like the Democrats prefer a federal police force over the local police, the sheriff's departments, where they are weakening them and calling for them to be defunded, et cetera, doing everything they can to undermine the local police.
Right.
Is there a connection, or is it just happenstance that this is happening? Are they doing it intentionally, in other words?
So I had a conversation with one of my colleagues on this very topic recently, within the last 72 hours. And it's all about what is really going on with the federal government. Now, a lot of us came up through it. I came up through it. I'm a retired civil servant, GS. I'm retired as a GS-14. And I'm also a retired lieutenant colonel, as both. And so I came through the bureaucracy, and I've been in the room with a lot of leaders over the years. I actually met Jim Woolsey. Jim and I are still friends, when he was director of CIA, when I was running one of those operations you read about in some spy novel. We do those things. And this was completely off the books. And he actually briefed it to President Clinton. And Jim's a Democrat, by the way, but he's not the Democrat of today.
Yeah. Was appointed by Clinton when he later left. I think my interview with him in 1999 was his, when he really broke ranks with the Clinton administration over tech transfers to China. And I asked him, I'd interviewed him a couple of times before that, and he wouldn't break. And then I let him into, I said, did you, you know, is China proliferating? And he said, of course, they're the third worst proliferators in the world. And I said, did you advise the president? He said, yes. Well, what was his reaction? He said, diplomatic day marches. And I said, then what was your reaction when he certified China as a nuclear non-proliferator in 1997? And that was the moment at which Woolsey realized that he had to throw it in. He was going to have to criticize Clinton, and he did. And from that point forward, he was highly critical and became a really kind of a hawk joining us on the right, I think, from that point forward. But yeah, he was originally a Democrat.
No, you said, look, full disclosure. I mean, Jim and I have worked together to advise multiple members of Congress. You know, look, we would go in and sit down with Tulsi Gabbard, for as a matter of fact. We'd sit down and, you know, Tulsi was looking for nonpartisan advice. Like, hey, we're nonpartisan. So that's my point, is that those who are aware of the real issues recognize that the bureaucracy should be there to establish an understanding of what is factually provable and accurate. Jim represented that when he was director. The operations we ran were very factual. Something happened, and he's telling me some of the stories about his interactions with John Brennan. By the way, Scott, do you want to guess what John Brennan's primary objective was when he was director of CIA? Any guesses?
I can't say what he says it was, but
well, according to Jim, what he was briefed on by you know, because they all get together and sniff each other's whatever, while the, you know, as former directors, and according to Jim, Brennan's primary objective was to make CIA the premier employer of gay and lesbian folks.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. It's like, last time I checked, your job is espionage and figuring things out. But that was what Jim said that Brennan, and I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. So,
well, you know, Brennan has admitted, and I would never repeat this, except I saw the video myself. It wasn't a deep fake. Him talking about being a communist back in the late 70s. And it was only, he joined the CIA when Carter was president, and he was terrified he was going to flunk his assessment. Polygraph. Yeah. So, I don't recall him ever swearing communism off. So I don't think he did.
No, it's really funny. I had to go in and I met with, you know, I was one of the other people I advised during the Trump years was Mike Pompeo. And I went into my first visit with Mike to talk about several issues there on the seventh floor. And I looked around the office and Mike looked at me kind of quizzically. It's like, what are you looking at? I said, you know, Mike, I am so gratified to see you took and removed all of John Brennan's prayer rugs. Good for you. And he was like, oh, my God, Tony, why do you say these things? Look, it was great. So. See, this is why I get in trouble all the time. I say these things to these
guys.
There was that
persistent rumor that he had converted. When I worked,
prayer rugs. Mike did confirm there were prayer rugs in that office when he came in there. Just saying. So,
well, you know. there were some. I would never mention any names, but there were persistent rumors back in 2002, 2003, 2004 timeframe about him, and that. In retrospect, and based on his inability,
can I tell a quick John Brennan story? So, real quick,
please do.
So I was in with MSNBC. I do all media. I don't discriminate. Anyway, I was in, and the makeup lady said, "You know, Colonel Schaefer, I did John Brennan's makeup last week, and I had to touch his face." So I said, "What was that like?" She said, "Well, Tony, it was like touching pure evil."
It might be. The makeup women at MSNBC are total. I had one years ago. They haven't had me on in years, but years ago I had one, and I made a joke, what I thought was going to be a joke. And she whispered in my ear, I don't recognize this place anymore.
Yeah.
And it was during the early years.
It was getting bizarre. I know.
It was.
Anyway, I'm so far off track. I'm sorry I took you off topic like that, but it was
No. Quite all right. It's very interesting. So let me shift gears to the Army. I can't identify people close to me who are in high-ranking positions and members of the military. I can't identify anybody, but somebody who looks closely would figure it out. But I get horror stories every day, not from the Army, but from the Air Force, about, in one case, a medical doctor who's an officer in the Air Force telling me that he is sickened by the fact that he's ordered to devote resources that they need, that are very scarce, to training on how to inculcate transsexuals into the Air Force.
Yeah.
One example, but I hear those all the time from military personnel.
Well, let me break it into two pieces. I just met with one of the, my colleagues from the Ohio Guard, I started off as enlisted and became a lieutenant. And one of my close friends and I met for breakfast when I was in Dayton recently. And we talked about some of this, you know, and he became a command sergeant major. Loved the man. You know, he helped mentor me when I was a lieutenant. And I was a very hard to control lieutenant, if you couldn't figure that out. And we were talking about the old days, and this very issue came up. And Jerry was his name. I don't think Jerry would mind me saying his name. It's like, fundamentally, we knew who the gays and lesbians were. We didn't care. It's like, you know, in the '80s, do whatever you want. Just don't put me in a position where I have to do something or say something. And that's changed now. It's like they don't want to just exist. They want to proclamate and force upon you a certain philosophy of sexuality. And to me, it's dangerous, especially when you get into this transgender issue. And this is why most people who are transgendered have a high suicide rate. First, and that tells me and others that it's a mental issue. There's a mental stability issue there that you don't want to deal with in the military. And you know, from being in the military, it's high stress, no matter what, where you're at, infantry all the way up to logistics. There's going to be times you're put in positions of high stress. You know, I've been on air assaults. I've been on, you know, in firefights. You don't want someone there who's not completely able to focus on the tasks at hand, especially when you have to go to rote memory just to get through sometimes. And the other thing is, besides the mental instability issue, is if you go through and start doing bottom surgery, that never heals. I've heard all sorts of horror stories about what comes of that. And plus just the drugs you have to take on a daily basis to quote unquote maintain whoever you think you are. These are things which are not that are not compatible with military service. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is, and I don't want to say this to
incompatible.
And so it's just not compatible. It's not something that we as the military should be dealing with, let alone the idea that you can come into the military and have the military pay for your gender change. And so these things I'm very clear on. And again, I could care less who you sleep with. What's funny, I do a lot of stuff with what we call the girls in our own. We do something called the Culture Wars, the Insurgency, with my think tank, London Center. And we have Shuri Curie from The Runaways, Susan Olson from, who's Cindy on the Brady Bunch, Jen Mathias from the Bell Stars in England. We all talk about this all the time. And so funny, these are all people he would consider liberals. They're all against this stuff. They understand what danger this transgenderism is doing to our military and to our kids. And so it's really interesting that all these people who were like flaming liberals back in the '80s are all like, oh, no, this has gone too far. And I get notes all the time from gay and lesbian friends saying, we're with you. We want to be pulled away from, you know, the L and G want to be pulled away from the rest of those alphabets. So this is where they've gone too far. And I think most people who understand the dangers to defense, to having a strong defense, and having a culture which allows for kids to be kids, these things are all related. And it's a very dangerous time to be in the military, because to say what I just said would probably get me called into some general somewhere. And I could say it certainly would. Anyway, so.
It absolutely would. We're speaking with best-selling author and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. We're going to take a short time out. We'll be back with more on Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio right after this.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
We're more than a year away from the Democrat and Republican Party nominating conventions, but already people are starting to express concerns over what role AI might play in the election. Darrell West, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Technology Innovation, says it's going to be very difficult for voters to distinguish the real from the fake, and you could just imagine how either Trump supporters or Biden supporters could use this technology to make the opponent look bad. There could be things that drop right before the election that nobody has a chance to take down. Gee, you think? Let's just take a little lesson from our military, who decided to see what would happen if you tasked AI with conducting drone strikes against surface-to-air missile batteries. There was a human override failsafe that would instruct the drones not to engage a target, but the AI decided that because it identified a SAM battery, it should destroy the SAM battery, and therefore the human was the problem. Thankfully, the drones weren't armed because the drones tried to take out the human that was sending it an override signal. Recognizing their quote-unquote programming error. They told the drones not to attack the human. So what did the drones do instead? They attacked the radio towers that were connecting the human to the drone. Sure, this technology can't get out of hand and cause any problems. No, not at all. AI needs to be regulated and regulated fast. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Although the government was established to protect the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of the American people, the deep state has been working hard to strip us of any claims to life and liberty. No matter who runs for office, no matter who controls the White House, now or in the future, we the people have already lost. Because the future of this nation is being forged beyond the reach of our laws, elections, and borders by techno-authoritarian powers with no regard for individuality, privacy, or freedom. The Rutherford Institute is deeply committed to protecting the constitutional freedoms of every American and the integral human rights of all people through its extensive legal and educational programs. We provide legal services at no charge to those whose constitutional and human rights have been threatened or violated. It's our job to make the government play by the rules of the Constitution. With your help, we will make America free again. Visit Rutherford.org and kindly donate today. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Tracking global corruption and threats that undermine our security.
Through the Looking Glass.
This is Through the Looking Glass with Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. We're speaking today, our expert witness is retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He's also a New York Times best-selling author, and he's also a former intel operative. So we have made great inroads into understanding a lot of what's happening in the country, thanks to Colonel Schaefer. Let me shift gears a little bit now and go to national security, because as you and I have known for decades now, China is a growing threat, and they are now becoming getting close to becoming an insurmountable threat. And you had mentioned off the air that you spoke to Mark Milley about the China threat, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What did you get out of that conversation?
So, yeah, just to give full context, during the last year of the Obama administration, I was called in to help advise a number of folks in the Obama administration. I mean, one of the things, Scott, I do, I will advise anybody who asks for the advice, no matter what their political colors are. I think if you're going to be honest as someone who advises on that, as a matter of fact, Tony Zinni, General Zinni, taught me this. He said, you know, Tony, your job is as a policy guy is to advise anybody who asks for the information. So it's like, yes, sir. I got
absolutely.
It.
Why yeah. not try to help, even if you disagree with the politics?
So God bless advice. General Zinni, and he made that point, and he made it. I agree with him, and Zinni's right. So I was advising folks who I didn't necessarily agree with, but within the context of that, I was asked to be part of the Trump transition team, and because of who I was advising at the time, I was actually assigned two seniors to be the go-between between Mike Flynn and the Pentagon. And the two individuals were the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, Fighting Joe Dunford, Marine Corps general, and then chief of staff of the Army, Mark Milley. And I knew both of them pretty, you know, well enough that I had corresponded with them on a regular basis before President Trump won. And so as part of the transition team, I had to sit down with Mark and go through, I don't know what you want to call it, a welcoming. It's like, hey, Mark, you know, what are you thinking? So my ask was, you know, look, there's certain things I think you, Mark, ought to look at bringing back within the Army. And I don't want to get into it because there was classified issues relating to it. I don't know if he ever did them or not, and probably not knowing what happened. But there are certain capabilities I think the Army has established and does very well at doing. There's some great books about it. Secret Warriors. There's some other things that have not been disclosed, but I think the Army does things very well when it puts its mind to it. So I talked about that. And he then lectured me, right, and not in a bad way, about the China threat. And one of the things he basically laid out is how he, Mark Milley, was convinced that the Chinese were out to dominate the Pacific Rim within the next 10 years. And that was like how many years ago now? It was back in 2016. So, you know, that's been a while. And in that context, he then lectured me on how he had read all of these doctrinal books within China and talked to their generals. And he actually told me about a specific conversation he had with one of the generals regarding, and this is what Mark said to me. He said, you know, Tony, I met with this general and I said, look, I read your book. And according to your book, it says that your military objective is to establish certain areas within the Pacific as Chinese sovereign territory. And the general said, yes. And Mark said, well, we're going to have problems then. Now, that's what Mark told me. So I had every reason to say, okay, great. You're talking tough to the Chinese. This is something that we should be paying attention to. And I still think we do. I think we need to do that. So it's very interesting that after all of that direct talk, and this is not Tony Schaefer hearing from a third person. This is Tony Schaefer sitting in Mark Milley's office, having this discussion with Mark about what he sees as the Chinese threat. And then to see how disappointing he's been over the past few years, I guess three, almost 4 years as chairman, to see that how bad it's been, it's very disconcerting, because it seems to me, Scott, that he went off and started focusing on all these issues we were just talking about, wokeisms, not understanding what's going on within the larger context of strategy. As the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, having now that I've advised a couple, their job is the primary is to be the primary advisor to the president. They technically do not command anything. They run a staff, a big staff. The imperial, as you know, the imperial staff, as some call it.
Yeah.
And they are essentially the brainstem between the White House and the president and the military commands. That's what their job is. So while they don't have inherent power, they have implied power by the fact that they're the conduit for all the power that goes through. So that's the context of where I was dealing with Mark. And so I've called out Mark a lot. You know, I've been, and again, I've talked to his staff a couple times. I actually offered Mark an opportunity to come and talk about some of the things that I thought maybe he had misspoke and wanted to clarify. He chose not to do it, and that's okay, you know. But it is what it is relating to the fact that I think that he should have been a lot more aggressive, especially regarding the last year with Lloyd Austin. So, by the way, full disclosure, I worked for Lloyd Austin when he was a brigadier general. He's the guy that approved my Bronze Star, as a matter of fact. I was assigned there in a different name. I was not Tony Schaefer, but I was there working for him back in the day. So I know these guys directly, and I'm just very disappointed based on my own direct experience in working with and around these guys in different times, how they're doing things right now.
You know, I spoke one time with Jerry Boykin, a three-star Lieutenant General.
Yeah, I know General Boykin. Yeah,
he had regarding the sector, the SecDef. He had the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. He seemed to have some fondness for him, but he ripped into Milley in a way that rarely you ever see one officer tearing into another, and it was not pretty. It was like he had no respect for him at all. Doesn't understand how he got to where he is, and except
it's
the way
clearly
most of Mark, them do politics.
It's Mark Milley's good looks, his boyish good looks, I think.
Yeah.
Must be.
Well, he or his willingness to understand white rage or something. But we now are facing this crisis with China, and it's not something that just appeared, even though some are just now recognizing it. I was there in the mid-90s and investigating. There was a lot of espionage taking place, and there was a lot of transfers of technology from during the Clinton administration to communist China over the objections of the Defense Technology Security Administration. Woolsey told me later how he objected to some of that tech transfer, while there were millions of dollars in illegal donations coming into the DNC and into the Clinton reelection campaign in 96, some intel people privately told me they and these a couple of these guys had voted for Clinton in 92 because they thought H.W. Bush was weak on China. And they voted for Clinton because in 92, he was saying, accusing Bush of coddling the butchers of Beijing and that sort of thing. And so they thought he was going to be tough on China, and human rights was a significant issue in 92. Then suddenly he gets into office and rips out the export control regimes.
Right.
And we had all this happening. Why were Republicans not smart enough to point this out when the Democrats were accusing Trump of collusion with Russia?
It's well documented.
Wrote a piece. Yeah, I wrote a piece for the, I think that one was in before the 16 election in the Examiner, the Washington Examiner, pointing out that the Clinton administration, you want to talk collusion, you had it in spades at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, but we had this, the China threat has been gathering for all these years, and suddenly people start recognizing it. What are their ambitions, do you think? What are they going to do next, do you think?
Yeah. Great question. And I'll be as succinct as possible because I know we're getting short on time. By the way, I highly recommend a book. You probably already read it. Bill Gertz wrote a book called Betrayal, where he documents a lot of the Clinton.
Yeah, I'm cited in there, I think.
Great. Yeah, it's a great book. I highly recommend people who want to really understand kind of the damage the Clinton administration did. I reference a resource that I have no affiliation with as somewhere people ought to go look at what I think China wants to do. It's actually U.S. Navy's proceedings. They've got a series of videos where they've had some deep analysis by some people who know. And I'll just let people go Google proceedings and Google that and look for China threat. And I got to tell you, Scott, they've done amazing work. And they can document everything, because I think one of the things that's abundantly clear is any war with China is going to be much like we had to deal with regarding Japan and the Pacific, very much an ocean-based war like we did during World War II. And so these Navy guys, God bless them. I don't know these guys personally, but they've done a great job of documenting everything we're talking about regarding how the Chinese are building up. And they very clearly state in these series of videos and discussions that the Chinese have basically, within their own doctrine, built rings coming out from China.
Change strategy. Yeah, I pointed this out in a documentary in 1999 called Trading
There you
with
go.
The Enemy,
yes.
How the
yeah.
Clinton administration
That's what
on
they're
China.
Doing. Yeah, and, they're not hiding it. They're not hiding it. Yeah,
this is Peter Leitner pointed out that this was Japan's strategy in World War II, the island chain strategy, and they were going to move the chain outward until they got to mainland China, and they had actually renamed Manchuria Manchukuo, and so the Chinese have replicated that strategy and are doing it in reverse, of course, going the other direction. But yeah, the island chain strategy, they intend their objectives to be the hegemony in the Pacific Rim, I think, is the beginning of something else. When we see the Belt and Road Initiative going through the Middle East and Africa and the Balkans, even last trip I was just 2 years ago, I was going to Montenegro or Croatia, somewhere over there. And the flight from Paris to Belgrade, it was almost entirely made up of Chinese engineers going to Belgrade. And so they're doing this in a very aggressive way. We've got about 2 minutes left. What is their objective? Do they have any design on pushing the United States back? And
they do. So basically their first step is to basically reestablish, because their laws are older than ours, and they'll tell you that. I've actually worked for Boeing on this, for Phantom Works. We did an inside out study where we became the Chinese for purposes of understanding. And the first objective is to basically reclaim all land that they feel is theirs. And that basically goes back to the Qing Dynasty, to their maximum extent of dynastic expansion. And they believe, we're older than you, we get all that back. That's what they're doing. That's simply what they're doing. They're just kind of collecting back what they think is theirs. beyond that, then they want to have complete influence and control of lines of communication, lines of commerce. That's why you see all these initiatives regarding. And by the way, they need that because they don't have sufficient fossil fuel to run their economy. And when you got 2 billion people and you got a lot of resources, resource needs, you're going to go about trying to secure those things, much like the Japanese did to cite what you're talking about, Scott. I think they're going to have very similar problems to what the Japanese had once they start this expansion. And yeah, I think they want to basically do what they want to be successful in the domination of the Pacific, where the Japanese failed. And by the way, there is a racial issue to this. The Han believe they are the chosen picked people. And I don't think people understand that these Han are of just another form of genetic imperialists who see themselves much like the Nazis did. And I'm not trying to be extreme here, but that's what they believe. They believe that they are destined by their deity to be the rulers of the planet. That's what they're ultimately going to try to do.
Absolutely. All of that I've seen firsthand. And I think you're absolutely spot on.
But Scott, people don't understand it. I mean, we've not done a good job of educating people. And I appreciate you being able to allow me some time to talk about this. This is important stuff.
I'd really like to have you back because I've got a whole series of questions for you. But let me take the opportunity to say thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to come on with us. We just spent the hour with retired Army Colonel Tony Schaefer, and he has been absolutely spectacular in his explanations about the current crisis in our own country and what we're facing abroad. Thank you all for joining us on Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. If you want to reach us on Twitter, it's @NewsCapGroup. And you can reach us that way. If you have questions for any broadcast, you can follow up there. Thank you again, and thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.